This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, and here is what's coming up.
It's been more than a half century since astronauts journeyed to the moon. Well, folks, that's about to change.
That's Bill Nelson, administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, on plans for a mission around the moon next year. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump to hear charges against him in court. In video, Tunisia's president makes first public appearance in 2 weeks. And Australia announces new landmine technology, detection technology. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to arrive shortly at a courthouse in New York City's Manhattan District to be arraigned on about 30 felony charges. I reached VOA's BMJ Murithi, who is at the courthouse, to find out what's going on there amid tight security and large crowds in a case that underscores America's deep political divisions.
So, yeah, I'm right outside the courtroom here in Lower Manhattan, where, as you know, former President Donald Trump is supposed to be arraigned. What is happening here is that there's a lot of people that gathered outside the criminal court here in Lower Manhattan, as was expected, because the former president, Donald Trump, is expected to be arraigned here any time from now. He is expected to be arriving here. And what you can hear in the background is, you know, there are, as I said, all manner of people here. Some are his supporters, and others are really not his supporters, and are really celebrating the fact that Donald Trump will be the first former president, or even a sitting president, to be charged with a criminal offense here in the United States.
People were worried about the protests near the courthouse. How is the situation? Are the protesters peaceful?
So far, I haven't seen anything that I can say is in terms of being chaotic. People are peaceful, but of course, tensions are rising. But I can also report to you that the security here is really, really beefed up. And so far, there haven't been any issues to report.
Those Trump supporters, are they in big numbers as expected or not?
Yes, there's quite a big number. Where I am, I see quite a number of them. And, you know, there are many more that are within streets that are beyond that my eye can catch. So I couldn't, I may not be able to tell you what is the number generally, but there's quite a number of the supporters. But I wouldn't say right now as we speak that I can see them demonstrating per se, but they are just here, you know, showing with placards, showing that they are in support of their leader, former President Donald Trump.
And I imagine business in Lower Manhattan must be at a standstill.
We could say so, but so far I saw some businesses are open, especially the ones that are not very close to the courthouse. But otherwise, of course, there's a lot of anxiety and even tension some of the streets here. But there are areas that business is going on, but everyone is talking about this case, and really nobody knows what course it will take, because as I said, this is a first of sorts, being the very first time that New York and the United States in general is experiencing this kind of a situation. Probably just to add that prior to this day, the mayor of New York spoke, and everybody you know, asked the people that will come anywhere close to the courtroom to behave themselves. So, but so far we haven't seen anything, as I said, that would get him worried. But you never know. Towards the end of the evening, as Trump leaves the courthouse and goes down to Mar-a-Lago, where we expect that he will issue a statement. We don't know what will happen, but we are here waiting to see, and we'll cover it.
That was VOA's BMJ Murithi speaking with me by phone from the courthouse in Manhattan. The arraignment will make Trump the first former American president to face criminal charges. Kabir Mato is a professor of political science at the University of Abuja, Nigeria. He tells me this is an expression of the supremacy of the rule of law and a lesson to leaders on the African continent.
I think it's simply an expression or manifestation of what the, you know, American democratic system is all about. I think it's simply an expression of the supremacy of the rule of law, and no one individual can grow taller or above the law. So in as much as people will try to, you know, put some political coloration to it, I think the most important thing is that we must be able to dig deep to see what infractions or alleged infractions that the former president is being accused of committing. I think that's the way to go. But one clear picture, as far as I'm concerned, is that it shows clearly that within a functional democratic system, everyone is within the confines of the law, and therefore the supremacy of the law exists. And that will serve as a very great lesson to those who aspire or those who are in political positions to know that obviously you cannot grow beyond a system that nurtures you.
Talking of lessons, how is the reaction in Africa, those people are talking to and hearing from, and what can be learned from this?
Well, the action in Africa is that it sends, you know, jitters to the spines of, leaders who loom in most cases larger than life. Yeah. But when you're a leader, you become untouchable, you become, you know, inaccessible, and you can commit any crime and you go scot-free even after you're out of office. So I think the lessons are tremendous. But one important lesson is the fact that It shows that you cannot grow beyond a system that nurtures you, like I said. And as a leader, you will be expected to play by the rules, to play the game by the rules, to ensure that you do things, whether in or out of office, based on conventions and the provisions of, you know, the statutes and rules of your particular environment. Otherwise, as soon as you are done, in the event that you are covered by some immunity while you are in office, as soon as you are done, you are likely to be apprehended and charged, you know, for these crimes that you are committing. So it's a very big lesson. It's going a long way in, you know, showing that leaders are not indispensable leaders. They are also infallible. So a lot of lesson to not just leaders in Africa, but virtually every, you know, citizen that find himself or herself within the realm of public life to take it easy and continue to function within the confines of the laws of the land in whatever country.
What would you say to those who claim that, despite saying that nobody is above the law, some leaders, maybe on the continent, use their powers to arrest their political opponents?
Yes, precisely. That's been the major challenge here on the continent of Africa and parts of Asia and Latin America. But I think examples like this, in very recent times, this basically is the first time that it's happening even in the United States of America. It's not often, it's not common. And like I said, it's going to serve as a very big lesson to our leaders here who, like I said, they loom larger than life. When you see things happening in larger democracies such as this, what you do is you also begin to take care of yourself and know that it's obvious that if you don't do well, or if you try to infract on, you know, the rules of the engagement, It is likely that no matter how long it takes, you're going to be apprehended, you're going to be found wanted.
That was Kabi Mato, a professor of political science at the University of Abuja, Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. Today is the International Day for the Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. Every year, thousands of people around the world are injured or killed by landmines and unexploded ordnances left by conflict. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines, latest landmine monitor, shows that in 2021, landmines and other explosive ordnances killed nearly 2,200 people and injured about 3,300 others. Almost all of the casualties were civilians, many were children. The Landmine Monitor reports that at least 20 countries and regions on the African continent experienced landmine casualties in 2021. The largest numbers were in Egypt and Nigeria. Some of the explosives are left behind from past conflict, as in Angola, but others, such as Cameroon, South Sudan and Mali, there is ongoing conflict. Removing landmines is a slow or dangerous process. Many mine clearers have been killed or injured over the past 25 years since the passage of the Mine Ban Treaty. However, Australia's National Science Agency has developed new landmine detection technology. The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization says its handheld device is faster and more reliable than conventional metal detectors. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian device uses magnetic resonance technology that can identify the molecular signature of explosives used in landmines. Unlike current metal detectors, it won't pinpoint bottle top shrapnel or other unrelated metallic items, saving mine clearance teams time and effort. Similar technology using short bursts of radio waves has helped the mining industry to differentiate valuable ore from common rock. CSIRO scientist David Miljack told VOA that the landmine technology also has similarities with a well-known medical device.
It's a related technology to the familiar things you'd find in the hospital, which is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. But it's a distant cousin, though, so the techniques we're using don't require that big magnetic field that people sit in. It's just the radio waves that are used. And we're picking up on a molecular signature of the explosive that might be in the ground or the soils.
Australia's Science Agency plans to send its handheld landmine detectors to parts of Southeast Asia in 2024. Miljack says they'll be used by humanitarian non-government organisations, including the Halo Trust, which carry out mine clearance activities throughout the world.
The plan is, in the next year, we'll take our advanced laboratory prototypes, which are performing very well, but make them really robust and fit for purpose in the field. And that will be through partnerships of our new company called MREED with NGOs like the Halo Trust.
It's estimated that over 100 million landmines have been scattered in more than 60 countries, causing around 6,500 casualties each year. The United Nations has declared April 4 the International Day for Mine Awareness and Assistance in Mine Action. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has appeared in a video on his Facebook page, putting to rest speculation that he was ill or that there was a power vacuum. According to Al Jazeera News, Saied had not appeared in public since March 22nd, and opponents had called on the government to explain his absence. Appearing alongside Prime Minister Najib Boudin, Saied called the concerned, in his words, a level of madness never seen before in Tunisia. Ahmed Najib Chebi of the opposition National Salvation Front coalition told journalists that if there was a power vacuum, the Prime Minister would step in. However, a permanent vacancy would present the country with an emergency, since the newly reformed parliament has few powers. Saied says opponents are trying to create a crisis, and Bloomberg News says the country's general prosecutor has promised to take on persons and social media pages that spread fake news liable to harm public security. On a trip last week to North Africa and the Middle East, Assistant Secretary of State for North Near Eastern Affairs, Barbara Leaf, met with Tunisia's foreign minister to discuss the country's critical economic and political changes. She said the U.S. is ready to support Tunisia if the leadership decides to go forward with its economic reform program. She also said if Tunisia's government decides not to pursue an International Monetary Fund restructuring arrangement, the U.S. is keen to know what their alternative plans are. Sarah Yeks, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, discussed Leaf's comments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi.
My understanding is that the main thing holding the IMF deal back right now is President Saied and the Tunisian government. The IMF and the international community are waiting for the Tunisian government to sign the economic reform plan, which they drafted. And until they do so, the IMF is not going to move forward. And because President Saied himself has been operating without any real checks on his power since the staff level agreement that was signed back in October, there's nothing preventing him from signing it at this point. So the growing speculation is that he does not actually intend to pursue the IMF deal, in which case it's not at all clear how he will address Tunisia's growing economic crisis. I think that is what Assistant Secretary Leaf was trying to get at there.
The U.S. diplomat emphasized that the U.S. remains committed to its longstanding support for the Tunisian people and their aspirations for a democratic and accountable government that preserves the space for free debate and dissent, safeguards human rights and fundamental freedoms for all, promotes long-term prosperity, and respects the rule of law. What is the U.S. message behind this statement?
The U.S. is trying to signal that it continues to support the Tunisian people while also dramatically cutting support to the Tunisian government. I think we saw this play out in President Biden's recent budget for fiscal year 24, where he cut Tunisia's assistance about in half, stating explicitly that this was because of the democratic challenges and the democratic backsliding that Saeed has implemented. I think, you know, the U.S. government would really like to see Tunisia return to a democratic path, and is trying to also signal to the many Tunisians who are still committed to democracy that the U.S. stands by them.
She stressed the importance of the work U.S. diplomats are engaging in with the Tunisian people as an important component of bilateral relations. Does that mean relying on engaging Tunisian civil society, as Tunisian government kept resenting U.S. advice as an intervention?
In a way, but I think that statement actually is really directly referring to Kais Saied's recent crackdown on Tunisian figures who are being targeted and arrested explicitly for meeting with U.S. and European diplomats. And I think Ambassador Leaf's point is that diplomats in every country engage with people in the government and outside the government as the regular course of business, much like the Tunisian diplomats here in Washington engage with American civil society actors. And this is a point the U.S. has really been trying to get across to Kais Saied and his team since the arrest took place. And I think Leaf's visit was just one more opportunity to emphasize that point. And I think actually part of her visit was spurred on by this uptick in these arrests. And she's really just trying to make clear that this is something diplomats do, and Tunisians should not be arrested or should not be under threat for simply meeting with American or other European diplomats.
So what do you make of not inviting Tunisia to the Democracy Conference in Washington?
Well, I think it was a pretty easy decision this time around. You know, last year's, or the Democracy Summit in 2021, came just a couple months after Saeed's self-coup. And that, while I think that was the right decision to not invite them, was a little bit more difficult for Washington to make. But now, I mean, Saeed has not done anything to make Tunisia more democratic since 2021. And so I don't think there's any reason why they should have changed their position on inviting Saeed this time.
That was Sarah Yanks, a senior fellow at Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi. You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impulga in Washington. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said today that the EU and the US would respond cautiously to a peace deal in Ethiopia's civil conflict. The French news agency AFP quoted Borrell as saying, "The message to both the government of Ethiopia and the Tigrayans is to make them understand that we are watching the settling of the conflict and will only normalize our relationship in a gradual way, step by step." Speaking after a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Borrell called the peace process one of the rare bits of good news that we have in the world. The two-year conflict pitted the Ethiopian government forces against the rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front. Peace talks in South Africa in November produced a truce. Three U.S. astronauts and one Canadian astronaut are slated to make history in NASA's upcoming Artemis II mission. VOA's Ken Farabaugh has more on the diverse crew scheduled to make the first lunar journey since 1972.
It's been more than a half century since astronauts journeyed to the moon. Well, folks, that's about to change.
Standing in Houston, Texas, before the current astronaut corps and veterans of the Apollo and Space Shuttle programs, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson introduced the four-member crew of Artemis II: Christina Cook, Victor Glover, Reid Wiseman, and Canadian Jeremy Hansen.
This is humanity's crew.
Reid Wiseman is mission commander for Artemis II, while Christina Cook and Jeremy Hansen will serve as mission specialists. Cook is set to make history as the first woman on a lunar mission, and Hansen as the first international astronaut to take such a journey, something NASA Administrator Nelson emphasized during the announcement.
We choose to go back to the moon and then on to Mars, and we're going to do it together. Because in the 21st century, NASA explores the cosmos with international partners.
Victor Glover, a U.S. naval aviator, will pilot the Orion spacecraft on the 10-day round-trip mission around the moon, testing the functions of the systems and equipment that future crews will use to eventually return to the lunar surface. In an interview with VOA before last year's Artemis 1 mission, Glover said he embraces the historic opportunity to be the first person of color assigned to a moon mission.
People keep asking me, you know, is it meaningful to you that little black kids look up to you and say they want to be like you? You know what? Let's be honest. I represent America. I'm a naval officer and I work for NASA. I represent America. And little white kids, little Mexican kids, little Hispanic kids, little Iranian kids follow what we're doing, because this is maybe one of the most recognizable symbols in the universe.
Not only is the makeup historic, the crew of Artemis II could also venture farther in space than any humans before them, traveling over 1 million total kilometers in a path that extends well beyond the moon before returning back to Earth. NASA says the exact distance and plan depends on a number of factors, including the date of the actual mission launch. At the end of the NASA ceremony introducing his crew, Reid Wiseman expressed the determination of the agency to further its goals in space despite repeated delays and cost overruns.
Three words that we keep saying in this Artemis program: we are going. And I want everybody to say it on three. One, two, three.
We are going!
NASA hopes to launch Artemis II as early as November 2024, with the first mission to the lunar surface as early as 2025. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
At least six people died and dozens are missing after a boat capsized yesterday on Lake Kivu in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The French news agency AFP says the vessel was carrying traders and goods from Mugote in South Kivu province to Goma, the capital of neighboring North Kivu. Local authorities say heavy winds caused the boat to sink about 20 kilometers into the journey. 80 of the 150 passengers managed to survive. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabro, and our engineer, Adrius Regis, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.